Session number 27341, Reel 7.
John Maybank, Reel 7. What was the pattern of operations after that first week during iceberg?
There was a routine. We were the ships had to be refueled by fleet train, and they would we'd be in an operational area, which was probably a couple of hundred miles off the coast, and then we'd move away so that the fleet train we meet up with this fleet train, which consisted of oilers and ammunition ships and victualling ships and a whole range of a huge number of merchant ships were used, and they were on a constant sort of flow to and from Australia, where they were, and we were the first in the world, I think, to be fed by freeze-dried foods, and we had chicken, it was remarkable. Fresh chicken, and they'd been frozen, and this was completely unique and marvellous, because we got good food and eggs and things like that, and wonderful stuff. So we lived very well, and although at times the ship, when we were in combat zone, we were always having to live hand to mouth in a way, we always went down and had a meal in the evening in the wardroom and a glass of port, and generally sort of we're able to relax. But it was, our ships were, and I'm getting off the point a bit, but it's important to realise those ships were steel tanks, and we were in hot waters, if you know what I mean. It was, we were closed down at night, and it was fiercely hot, because there was no air ventilation in these ships. They were made for northern waters, and no one thought that they'd need fresh air blowing through them. So consequently, they sweated, and they were hot and sticky and not easy to live in. So most of us would grab a hammock, or not a hammock, but a stretcher bed thing, and go up on the deck, not the flight deck, the quarter deck, and toss this thing down and sleep there with nothing on, perhaps a sheet only, just to cover ourselves. And it's many a night that I've been lying on that quarter deck, and there'd be burial parties taking place, and they would just be, there'd be a little service held, and there'd be, and we more often than not, we'd go to sleep again while they were happening, because we were tired. We were flying 6 and 8 hours a day, and so we would, this was in combat area, they didn't hang on to bodies, because bodies would go off a bit, and we did lose people, we had attacks with kamikazes, and people were killed. I don't say this was happening every night, of course it wasn't, but there were occasions when they buried people at sea, and that's where they were buried, from the quarterdeck, which was at the stern of the ship. Underneath the flight deck was this quarterdeck. That's where we held parties as well. Now, you were asking about the routines. Well, basically, the 2 days flying in action, whether you were on combat patrol or doing strafing, and normally you might do 6 hours a day, and then for a couple of days you'd be on this activity, and then you'd be away for 3 days doing this refueling, and then back for 2 more days, and then out for 3 days, and back for 2 more days, and that went on throughout the period. So for example, for the whole of May, there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I only flew 9 times, about 25 hours. But during that time, I was, I noticed here that in May I was, mock attacks on the BPF at Leyte boosted off. That was I was sent off by a catapult.
Can you explain that for us?
Yes, indeed. The aircraft was linked to a catapult, a steam catapult, but with a stirrup or a strop. And they always lost the strop. It went off and was flung in front of the aircraft. And the aircraft was actually flung off the ship along this rail thing, which was inset into the deck. And the strop ran along to the end, and then which was held onto the aircraft. And when it got to the end, it fell off the aeroplane because there was nothing to hold it on any longer. And the aircraft would be at 90 knots at the end of the runway, at the end of this. So you were airborne. And you just, the throttle was open wide anyway, so you just kept on flying. It was quite an incredible experience there, because you went, in something like sort of 50 feet, you went from nothing to 90 miles an hour. And it was a thrill, I tell you. And I was the last one on Vic. This is when I got there, I was on Victorious, to be butt boosted off because it was hit by a kamikaze the next day. And, the next time the aircraft carrier got into action. And she was hit by a kamikaze, and it destroyed the catapult, and that was the end of it. But
you mentioned an operation against Formosa.
Yes, that was on Illustrious. During the first period, we attacked. Right, on the 12th of April, we did the fleet attacked Formosa, and my flight was given the task of looking at and attacking a radar position on a little island called Yonakumi Shima, and we strafed this radar installation, and afterwards we could see the aircraft all jockeying for position in the gun through the gun camera. Now, I don't know how we didn't shoot one another down, and we destroyed this thing. It was absolutely incredible how quickly it was knocked over, and then after that we strafed a bit of shipping and then circled around the island, and there was an aircraft burnt. That was on the ground, and there were harbour installations which we attacked, and then we were there altogether 3 hours and 45 minutes on that operation, and it was quite exciting because it was the first time there was no ACAC fire that we could see, so we were able to get quite low and have a good sniff at the place, and there was nothing there. It was farmland, really. It's a little tiny island, but it had this radar position, and that's what they're anxious to knock out and get rid of. So our little flight of four went over and did that. So that was quite fun. And but we did lose some people there. There was a chap called Jake Millard was killed that day.
How was he lost?
He was lost. He ran out of fuel. I think there had been an accident on the ship, and he was it was the North Formosa we were attacking, and he went down in the sea when he couldn't land back on the carrier because there'd been a fire on board the carrier deck, and they couldn't land on. And I think he must have been lost. And I brought here may have been in the sea. That's the only. I don't think he was shot down. Otherwise, it was just. But I didn't know what had happened to him when I wrote that, because that was done on the day.
Were you aware of any facilities that were available for you for air sea rescue time?
We didn't know that the Americans had submarines. At least no one ever told us. We depended upon. The Walrus aircraft that we had, and as far as we were concerned, that's all there was in it. But in fact, the Americans had quite a lot of aircraft, and their great big Mariner flying boats were doing quite a bit of picking up of aircrew, And submarines were very much in the area and were picking up lost aircrew. I think they must have lost a lot anyway, but they certainly picked up quite a lot. I know a friend of mine was picked up, Ian Sterling, and if you read your diary in there, you'll see that a fellow called Nottingham, he was picked up from on an Austrias. But he was picked up by a submarine.
But you didn't have any awareness of that kind of facilities were available?
No. No one told us that there were submarines. I think they probably didn't want to give us too much enthusiasm for ditching.
Well, it brings to mind another question. Obviously, you were aware of what the Japanese were like in their treatment of prisoners. At that time, would you not have wanted to be made prisoner of war if you could help it?
No, we knew about the Japanese chopping heads off. Now, don't tell me how I knew, but there was rumour that the Japanese were pretty brutal and they weren't taking prisoners. I think probably that information had come through from Burma, and so we knew we had a fairly savage foe.
Were you aware that they particularly targeted airmen at all?
No, we didn't know that. We weren't too bothered about it. I don't think anybody would have been too keen to have done anything had they thought they were going to lose their lives with somebody chopping their head off. But the majority that landed were killed after they'd landed. I'm pretty sure that, well, most of them we've heard about. But Cameron, this friend of mine, New Zealander, he survived, even though he escaped. Why, he tried to escape on Ishigaki, God alone knows. But he did, and they sent him off to Japan, and he was in Japan in a prison there for... He was only shot down in June and he was out in August. He lost 4.5 stone in those few months. So it shows you how badly they fed them. But I had a friend of mine called Mike Merritt, who was our NVR lady. And one day he said to me, Johnny, he said, I had a bad dream last night. And we were standing by the course there, and he said, I dreamt that I was shot down in flames. I saw don't worry about it, it's just the sort of dream one would have. I said, I have all sorts of nightmares like that. Anyway, the next day he went up and he was shot down in flames over the township of Miyako, in the town. Same day as Winnie Churchill was lost, hit in the centre of the town of Harare. So there we are. So this sort of pre-destiny dream was fulfilled. Now, whether that was because he couldn't resist it or what, I don't know. But he was shot down.
Could I ask you something else as well? You mentioned how uncomfortable it was inside the aircraft carrier in the heat. When you were doing, say, a combat air patrol, how uncomfortable was it in the aircraft?
Oh, it wasn't that uncomfortable. It was pretty warm. If you got a hot day, you were sitting in that cockpit, which was unpressurized. So you could open up the hatch a little bit without getting swept away and let the air in, but that was sometimes a bit uncomfortable too because it was too agitating. But you were sweating a lot of the time, and I got the most fearsome prickly heat between my thighs and around my shoulders and down my chest. And I think probably I had a dermatitis on my face, which of course stayed for years. I mean, dermatitis broke out again years later. And it was around the rubber mask, oxygen mask around my face, where the rubber rotted. And of course, it's not good for you, rotten rubber against your face. And so I broke out into dermatitis sores around here. But the heat was that intense. And they tried to repair it by giving me calamine. And the calamine, they put some black stuff in with it. What would it be? Anyway, it's a spirit. And of course, putting that around your testicles and between your legs, it smarted like hell. I said, well, to hell with that. Anyway, they stopped doing that because obviously it was aggravating rather than curing. And so they just gave me simple calamine, chamomile rather, and is it chamomile or calamine? Calamine, isn't it? Lotion. And it sort of cleared it up, but I had to get out of the tropics for it to go properly. So I was with that all my last, all the time. After the first couple of months, I had it there in one form or another for about 4 months.
And what about flying clothing? What were you wearing?
Well, sometimes a pair of pajamas and a flying jacket, flying suit, because it was so bloody hot. It really was very hot, but not always. And so sometimes I'd be in a pair of blue pants, shirt, and then a flying suit. I never wore a uniform. Very rarely did I wear a uniform. A jacket or anything. It was too hot.
Would you wear the long trousers?
I wore long trousers. I didn't fly in shorts.
I was wondering if there's any restrictions against flying in shorts.
Well, we didn't have fire-retarding materials, so it wouldn't have mattered whether you're in shorts or whether you weren't. I flew in shorts, I think, at Putnam a time or two, but basically I preferred the material. It absorbs the sweat a bit, you know. Well, in Putnam, you see, it was very hot there too, as well as in the Pacific. It wasn't a pleasant business flying in the war in this area because of the heat. Yeah.
How did the iceberg operations come to an end? What happened next?
Really? Well, after the Okinawa campaign was finished, there was no need for us to continue, because we were only there to stop aircraft flying up from Formosa, and that once they had airfields on Okinawa, they were able to do it themselves. You see, they didn't need a fleet at sea, which was a hell of a expensive exercise, and I don't know that the Americans were all that grateful to us. You know, I think they rather thought that we were stealing their thunder, which of course was rubbish. We weren't making much thunder, we were just doing our own thing, really. But we were taking part in an operation which had huge importance, really, in the history of things. But and of course, probably getting ready for an invasion, because there was going to be an invasion, and they had several hundreds, if not a thousand, aircrew down in Sydney waiting to take part in a massive invasion that was going to be taking part in November, I believe, against the Japanese homeland. And I'm grateful they didn't do it, because it would have been a murderous operation. The Japanese had quite a large army and a couple of thousand aircraft, which we weren't using against us. They were saving them for an invasion. And they had some pretty well-developed kamikaze machines, one kind or another, either in boat form or aircraft form, to attack any fleet that was going to attack them. And there are some records, apparently, that the Americans have showing what the invasion would consist of. Probably about 1 million men or something was going to attack southern Honshu. And all the carriers, well, all our carriers, I mean, the kamikazes were quite effective, you know.
I was going to say, can you tell me something about the kamikaze attacks that you were aware of on your carriers?
Well, yes. I can't recall what dates, because I didn't record a lot of the kamikaze activity, but I do recall sitting on the deck one day when the air raid warning went off, and no one told us to get out of the aircraft, and here we were sitting in the aircraft with the engines turning over and the ship not turning into wind for us to take off. And of course, when a ship is being attacked, it's all over the place, you know. They're trying to avoid bombs and aircraft and firing and what have you. And here were we sitting in the aircraft. Well, I think they probably intended we should get out of our aircraft or get airborne, one or the other, but they didn't do either. And we sat there, and in the end, I turned the engine off and got out and went down below. I mean, I wasn't going to sit up there and get hammered just for the hell of it. No one said anything afterwards. I got back in the aircraft eventually. It was all over and got it going again. But and I suppose I must have got airborne at some stage and did a combat air patrol. But being in an aircraft is a very, very frightening business if there's an air raid coming in, because I'd seen the Formidable hit. I'd been flying that day, and we came down, and we'd had some food, and we were on the quarter deck and looking, just watching, and there was an air raid warning, and Teddy Hamilton Davis and I were standing together, and we saw this airplane. I said, "Tennessee bugger, he's going to get shot at if he's not careful." I thought it was one of ours. And then I saw this puffs of smoke coming from his wings, and I said, "That silly sod's firing." And he was firing at Formidable. And then he swooped over the deck, along the deck, and up. And as he went and started up, our ship started to fire at him. And he went up in an arc, and at the top of the arc, he just pulled a stick back, and he went straight down into the middle of the deck. And we watched it. I bet our mouths were both open and never seen anything so horrifying or quite splendid, too, in a way. And he blew up an aircraft and bits of bomb and stuff. And, of course, the pilot and the air crew just disappeared. He made a hole in the deck. They concreted that hole over, and they were flying again in an hour and a half.
There was a difference, wasn't there, between the American and the British?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're all wooden decks, and we were steel decks. We had 4.5 inches of thick steel in the middle of the deck, and it tapered off to about 0.5 inch at the stern and the foredeck and the bow, but it tapered, so you had a huge 4.5 inch thick steel deck. And of course, all this hot decking made it, with the sun on it, it was just going straight through the ship, and the ship became very hot, which accounted for what I was describing earlier. Kamikazes didn't have a great deal of success with us. Now, on another occasion, I'd been on a flight. I don't know whether it was a strafing run. It doesn't matter. They were all sort of either a reconnaissance over the islands or a straf or a combat air patrol. And I arrived back. I think it had been a strafing run because I'd been over the islands, and I came back, and all was quiet, and I landed on, and the petty officer was pulling me up, and he parking us over on the starboard side. Well, normally we'd park across the front of the deck, and I couldn't understand this, but anyway, I went where he was, so I was watching him, you see, and he was pulling me across the deck, and he said, "Right, cut." So I cut the engine. Of course, our wings are up like this, folded up. And I called out to him, I said, "Why over here?" He said, and he pointed, there's a hole. And it had been hit by a kamikaze, and we'd lost, I think, about 10 killed and 14 wounded. That was the 4-inch guns, gun turrets had been hit by the lift, and that's when the lift came off. So that was the sort of incident of a kamikaze attack I didn't witness. I'd been on Illustrious when she was hit, and I was down in the wardroom. That was the first attack of kamikaze that we knew about. So I didn't see that one, but that, I've got a picture of him somewhere, of the kamikaze flashing past the island. Somebody took a photograph of it just prior to hitting. But I think it was the bomb that went off. I think it did some damage to Illustrious. She had to go home after the 26th of April because she was in need of serious repairs. She went back to England.
Exactly. Did you transfer over to Victoria?
That's, we transferred over on the 26th of April. So I was only on board a little over 6 weeks, and then I was on Victorious.
And you also mentioned that Victorious's steam catapult was hit by a kamikaze.
Yes, it was the steam catapult on Victorious that was hit. I've dived about in time. I went back to the Illustrious to describe the fact that I was in the wardroom when we had one. I went down there deliberately, actually, to get a cup of something. Two of us went down there just to say, well, we'll get out of the way of all the stuff that's going on. Let's go down to the wardroom. Of course, it's a silly thing to do because, you see, you're in a fairly sort of vulnerable part of the ship in the wardroom. I mean, the hull is quite thin there, although there's plenty of deck above us. But then anywhere in that carrier, there was plenty of deck above us. Most of the carriers were hit by kamikazes, and they to one degree or another, they were badly or not so badly knocked about. But they were all operating again within a very short space of time, and formidable, as I say, an hour and a half. And although we took on board her air crew that were flying, they landed on us and probably other carriers, they were soon back in the air and back on their own carrier. I had one experience when I was in Illustrious of where somebody had crashed and made a mess on the deck, and there was quite a bit of that, and I had to land on Victorious, and we had something to eat, and then they sent us back to Ishigaki on another strike on behalf of Victorious, which made us very upset because it wasn't our ship that had sent us off, and we sort of objected strongly. And they got the Illustrious sent a rather snotty letter or signal over to the commander flying for permitting our air crew to be flying on his bloody missions, keep his nose out of our affairs, sort of thing.
So at the end of the Okinawa campaign, what happened to your
squadron? At the end of the Okinawa campaign, we went back to Sydney, and we went back to Sydney for leave, and then a few more hours of working up before we went back to sea again. I think we were down there a couple of weeks, and then we were back on our way up to Japan, and that was in July.